Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank, which is holding a series of exceptional live recording sessions to cover our analysis of the economic consequences of the war in Ukraine as it is unfolding. Today, we will have an update on the implications of the sanctions on Russia, with a particular focus on those aimed directly to the financial and banking system. I'm here with our senior fellow, Nicolas Véron, who is joining us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Nicolas. How are you?
Hi, Giuseppe. Thanks for having us today.
And I'm also happy to host Elina Rybakova, who is the deputy chief economist at the Institute of International Finance, also based in Washington, D.C. Hi, Elina. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, it's nice to see you. And we even saw each other with Nicolas this week for a coffee in person. So D.C. has been very busy this week.
Great. And great that you're both in Washington and you can meet. So both of you have also already participated in some of those special sessions of The Sound of Economics back in February at the beginning of the Russian attack in Ukraine. With Elina, we discussed the role of China. And with Nicolas, we had the first conversation about today's topic, the implications for the financial systems of the sanctions. You will find the links to both episodes in the show notes. As we are having our conversation recorded on Twitter Spaces, we want this to be an interactive conversation. And after setting the scene with Nicolas and Elina, we will invite some of you on stage and ask questions. So, to recap, going on the topic, we have seen a wave of sanctions touching both the financial and the banking system since the beginning of the war. Namely, those included central bank sanctions, SWIFT, export controls, commodity bans, and more. On 6 April 2022, the United States Treasury announced full blocking sanctions on Sberbank and Alpha Bank, Russia's fourth largest bank, meaning U.S. entities cannot conduct any transactions with them and their U.S. assets are frozen. Together with the previous actions announced on 22 February and 24 February, this leaves 6 out of Russia's top 10 banks, representing more than 60% of total Russian banking assets, largely or completely prevented from any transactions subject to U.S. jurisdiction. Nicolas, you have written in a recent blog at Bruegel that on the banking front, the EU could do more as well. Why has the EU been so cautious so far, comparing to the United States that we just mentioned? And what is your take on that?
It's a really good question, Giuseppe, and I'm not sure I have the answer. So the big fish here is really Sberbank, because Sberbank is, by some measures, half of the Russian banking sector. There are few countries where one single bank is so dominant, especially with retail banking, but also with a lot of corporate banking as well. And it's a state-owned bank. It's basically its signature is the same as a Russian state. It's not indispensable for energy payments. You can, and actually most of the energy payments already go through other banks, especially Gazprom Bank and also another bank affiliated with Rosneft. So it is puzzling that the EU stance, which is to allow energy and gas deliveries and, of course, humanitarian-related transactions, but basically degrade, in the words of the European Commission, the Russian economy as a whole. It's puzzling that they haven't introduced sanctions on Sberbank yet. Ursula von der Leyen, this weekend, after our blog was published, no causation here, of course, only correlation, did suggest that they were preparing sanctions on Sberbank, but to my knowledge, nothing has been announced yet. So I really don't know why, and I am curious about views from the audience. One possible hypothesis is that it's non-energy related business transactions that some member states of the EU want to preserve. But then the question is, how does that square with the EU strategic objectives of supporting Ukraine? And again, as the Commission puts it, degrading the Russian economy.
Thank you, Nicolas. Elina, I would like to take some steps back and understand a little bit more about the impact of these sanctions. In a recent lecture at Princeton, you suggested that Russia has been planning on withstanding some external shock since 2014. Could you perhaps explain to our listeners how this was exactly played out? Also to kind of complement and give more context to what we just heard from Nicholas.
Thank you so much. Yes, so Russia indeed has been planning with their so-called Fortress Russia strategy since 2014, strengthening institutions, building up their reserves, and also cutting down their fiscal spending in order to be more protected from a sort of a more traditional balance of payments like shock that they were expecting from sanctions. Just to remind you, we started with aggressive financial sector sanctions on Russia in 2014, when Russian corporates and banks were disconnected from ability to borrow abroad via sectoral sanctions. And as a result of that, Russian total external gross debt went down from 700 billion to about, to less than 500. The repayment of 250 billion took place in about a year. So this was a significant shock to the Russian economy, even though in the end, the decline of the economy was not so sharp. So what the authorities have done was a sort of a coordinated strategy by macro technocrats on the Ministry of Finance and the central bank side. So on the Ministry of Finance, they realized that they cannot cut spending fast enough, but in the short run, they do need foreign investors to participate in their government bond market. On the central bank side, they realized, wait, over time, we do need to have some sort of domestic sources of funding as well. We need to have sort of stability, inflation targeting. We need to clean up the financial system. So central bank moved on to clean up the financial system, reduce the number of banks from almost to more than 1,000 to about 400 now, and also introduce inflation targeting. So the combination of these reforms made Russia very attractive, and a lot of investors came into the Russian local government debt market. But with time, as Russia cut down their fiscal spending, introduced fiscal rule, foreign investors became less relevant. So Russia was, in a way, very proud of this Fortress Russia strategy, large accumulation of reserves. Of course, as we saw with the latest round of financial sanctions, sort of cutting off or taking over the big stock of Russian reserves, more than 300 billion, potentially out of 640 at the time, that was a significant blow to this Fortress Russia strategy. Happy to do so. So I think the West has been very successful in terms of finding points of leverage, something that is sort of has power off and would be less painful to the global economy and to the Western countries. But at the same time, Russia is very reliant on and would be very painful for Russia. So in 2014, that was external borrowing of Russian corporates and state-controlled banks. And then since then, in this time around, it was sort of undermining Fortress Russia's strategy by taking away the reserves that they have so carefully amassed, more than 600 billion before the war.
Nicola, do you have some additional comments or reflections on what Elena just said?
No, I think she's entirely right. There was this powerful Fortress Russia strategy. The sanctions on the central bank, which were announced on February 26, have basically undermined the credibility of that strategy, at least in the short term. Now, at the same time, we have to recognize that some of those preparations for war, because this is what it was, have been at least in to some degree successful, by which I mean that at this point, Russia is able to finance its war on a day-to-day basis through oil and gas sales. And thanks to its oil and gas sales, it gets a positive current account balance, which is critical, of course, to avoid dramatically negative economic outcomes. I think the sanctions, as they have been applied and other things that have been happening, including companies leaving Russia for reputational concerns, are harming the Russian economy, especially at the structural level. So the growth potential, medium to long term, of the Russian economy has decreased in the last few weeks. But if we're looking for short-term impact, at this point, it's all on the military field, which probably is inevitable. Now, if we want to move on from this situation to a situation where Russia is further undermined, the next step, obviously, is to decrease EU purchases of oil and gas, and also to deter purchases of Russian oil and gas from the rest of the world. And this is where the main discussion is right now.
I would like to add something on this and perhaps ask a question, because I have to say something that I found a little bit baffling or very hard to understand for a non-specialist as I am, is the impact on this on the currency, on the ruble. Because we have seen some sort of apparent normalization of the currency in the past weeks. We've been seeing the beginning, there was almost a crash and so on, and now we're seeing a normalization. How we explain that normalization of the ruble, and also what does it say about this preparations that that Elena was mentioned about Russia trying to prepare itself for such kind of shock, and how sustainable in the long run is this situation?
Elena, do you want to take that one?
Thank you. Yes, let me start. So, there are a lot of questions we get exactly on the ruble, and the answer is yes or no. Has it strengthened? Yes, it has strengthened. It's a real strengthening. And what Nicola also mentioned, the large current account surplus, we've had 58 billion current account surplus, and different people forecast have different forecasts, but if we preserve the status quo, we could have more than 200 billion surplus this year, possibly even up to 300. And that's relative to the sort of reserves that are frozen. They could rebuild those reserves, maybe not at the central bank because of sanctions, but they could rebuild it in another bank. So therefore, ruble is strengthening. At the same time, you have severe capital controls. They're not planning to repay. They're having difficulties, and I think personally they have unwillingness to repay external debt of the corporates. Domestic brokers are required not to honor foreign investors' requests for divestment from the fixed income or equity market. And then individuals had their foreign reserves deposits frozen and also have difficulties converting into foreign exchange because of the capital controls. So it is interesting that ruble has strengthened so much that the central bank is beginning to loosen up a little bit some of these controls. In terms of the effectiveness of the sanctions, one factor that also has changed since 2014, we have a much more skilled team at the central bank. The response was very good from the classical sort of balance of payments response, even though this also included capital controls. They didn't wait. They doubled interest rate. They immediately imposed capital controls. They provided liquidity where it was needed to banks. And Nicola talked about Sberbank. Even Sberbank had runs. We do know for a fact that starting from the announcement of the sanctions, we had runs on. There were lines at the branches, mostly, however, for foreign exchange deposits in the end. The way that the central bank reacted shows you, if you look at the monthly statistic now, there is very little sort of quantitative and evidence of the bank run. Because if you go look at one sort of day to day or week to week, yes, you see that. You see that also from the liquidity position of the central bank. But if you look at the monthly change in deposits, for example, there is very little of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Elena, for that. And the other question on the table is obviously linked to the rest of the world, which has not aligned with the sanctions. Not only China, which we have discussed at length in our other conversation with Elena, but also India and the others. Can you, both of you, give us an overview on the facility Russia still has to run financial businesses with other parts of the world? To what extent this circumvents or just diminishes the damage of the sanctions?
I'll take a little bit of a go at this one. I think we have a very fluid situation beyond the core countries that are friends of Ukraine. So, but that group of core countries should actually not be called the West, because it goes way beyond a traditional understanding of the West, which is white, and formerly colonial powers. So I think the label the West is a bit unfortunate seen from the rest of the world, because it evokes bad memories. But the group of friends of Ukraine at this point is basically all of Europe with nuances, the United States, Canada, the UK, which is in Europe, of course, the Switzerland, all the offshore financial centers Monaco, Liechtenstein, you name it. The only significant exception is the UAE with Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, but all the others, and Hong Kong, of course, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, so major Asian economies as well. And that's a big group. If you think of the G20, that group includes all 10 richest members of the G20 by GDP per capita. None of the 10 poorest members, but all of the richest members, which is a good start and represents much more than half of the global economy. So then you have Russia, which is very isolated. It basically has no friends, leaving aside Belarus and, you know, literally three countries in the rest of the world, Syria, Eritrea, and North Korea, judging by the UN vote. And then you have this rest of the world group, which is kind of sitting on the fence. And it's not just China. It's India, to a certain extent, Indonesia, even so Indonesia voted against Russia at the UN. It's South Africa, much of Latin America with nuances, much of Central Asia, et cetera, et cetera. So these are in play, and they know it, and that's in a way why they remain neutral, because they can play one camp against the other, and China evidently does a little bit of that. But at the same time, if you look at the economic stakes, there is no question, even for China, that having access to the Russian economy is worth nothing compared to having access to the pro-Ukraine bloc of countries. It's a factor of 1 to 20 or more, depending on what you look at. So they don't want to lose that access to the free world, if you want to call it that way, which, of course, is not the right way to call it. And we're seeing in the financial sector some really intriguing developments. For example, it seems to be the case that UnionPay, the Chinese international payment card system, is stopping its activity in Russia, the way MasterCard and Visa have done shortly after the invasion. If that is confirmed, and it looks like this is happening, this is a major step of further disconnection of Russia from the international financial system. So there is a kind of lazy narrative that China is on Russia's side, but this is not at all what we observe in the financial sphere.
Elena?
Well, I think actually I like how Nicola sort of pointed out that the West is not the right way of putting it, and also feeds a little bit more into Russia's narrative, which sees itself as fighting the rest of the world, of the Western world, and sort of so we shouldn't be propagating that narrative either. I think the unique feature of the sanctions has been the degree of coordination. Each individual sanction was sort of important. We had a lot of nuclear options. Many of them were put together. But I think the speed and the degree of coordination was outstanding. And I think it also has something to do with the current administration in the US that was preparing the review of sanctions already before, as soon as they joined. Unfortunately, we in the public sphere only got the very abridged version of it. But we do know that they've been working closely with the international partners as they were working on that review. So when the time came to start preparing for more around November, when everybody was talking about the sort of accumulation of the troops, even further accumulation of the Russian troops at the Ukrainian border, they had the contacts, they had the expertise, and they could work quickly when the time came. So I think this is definitely an important, unique feature. So in terms of circumvention of those sanctions, Russia might have some options, right? There is sort of possibility of smuggling via Turkey or Kazakhstan or Armenia parts. You know, there's possibility of buying more expensively second-rate and third-rate technology from China. There is some possibility to divert oil, less so gas, but not even oil, as we all know, to Asia. But clearly, the fact that it's such a sort of such a coordinated global action, it makes the leakage much smaller. And of course, everything hinges on the end of the war on Ukraine.
Thank you. So basically, your take, to kind of summarize, if I understand correctly, is that, yes, of course, there is not a global alignment, but the Russian take on this, like the Russian view that this is a West against the rest of the world, is not what is the reality on the ground on one hand. And then on the other hand is that indeed even those countries like China that didn't expressly put themselves forward agreeing on the sanctions, they are still not circumventing the sanctions, and that therefore the sanctions are playing a leverage role to the rest of the world as well. So if I understand correctly, there is a quite limited impact on those countries that are not supporting the sanctions, if I understand correctly. I don't know if you understand what I mean. And if you can confirm that, like your take is that those sanctions are actually being effective and having a trickle down effect also because some of those countries that have not supported formally the sanctions are not going to go against the sanctions frontally.
Yeah, but I think you have to look at it really dynamically and not statically. This is not something that stays over time. It's a constantly changing situation. The sanctions that were decided in late February, early March, some of them are only taking full effect right now as we speak, or even later. And you know, the Russian side finds way, as they should, to circumvent them, and therefore you have to constantly update the panoply of sanctions so that these avenues for circumvention are closed. This is one reason why, together with Josh Kirshenbaum, we have advocated introducing sanctions on more Russian banks, including Sberbank. It's probably not a game changer. It is a small thing in comparison to the discussion about a ban on oil purchases, but it's a way to make the system tighter and to close some avenues for cross-border business seen from Russia that are currently still open. So essentially, it's a constant game of evolving positions, like the war itself, by the way, even so this shouldn't be called a war, but it's prompted by the war and only makes sense in the context of the war. As for third countries, I think you also have to look at it dynamically. The situation is very fluid. So, for example, in the first few days of the war, probably China was expecting to support Russia because they were expecting a short war where Russia would be victorious, which, frankly, most people expected given the disproportion of military strength, or at least on paper. Now, we've seen the Ukrainians respond very strongly, at least in the first months, 2 months of the war, and that changes China's calculation. How the military situation will evolve may again change the calculations from a number of countries. So I think this dynamic element, this changing element over time, is really critically important for the assessment.
Thank you, Nicolas, for this clarification. I think it puts it in perspective, this dynamic aspect of what we are discussing about, which brings me to another question, which is, you mentioned it before, Nicolas, when we started to discuss about the European reaction. Obviously, the big elephant in the room is the possible ban on oil and gas. This is the big pot, you know, this is the big shot to a certain extent. What would it be the impact of such a ban on the financial system specifically? If we can say something about it.
Yes, maybe. I think oil and gas is definitely where the action will be. And, as we're talking here, sanctions are a moving target. A lot of has been done on the financial sector sanctions. We've done it since 2014. There are some experts where the cleaning up remains. And, Nicolas was pointing that out for sure. But we're definitely now at the new stage. The new stage is all focused on oil and gas, an ability of Europe to pivot away from Russian oil products, and then eventually gas. Why does it matter? Because it matters, again, at the core of the balance of payments and fiscal position of Russia. You will be undermining then the ability of the Russian government to generate foreign exchange inflows and revenues. Because oil and gas account almost half, a little bit more than that, of current account inflows, export inflows. And then for the budget, oil and gas revenues, depending on the condition of other revenues, and of course, with the contraction in the economy, they will likely shrink. During recession, they account for almost half of federal budget revenues. And of course, it's a bit less for the consolidated budget. Long story short, this is where Russia gets foreign exchange. This is where Russia gets the ability to finance the war. Of course, other measures like export controls and self-sanctioning by countries make the break down the supply chains to Russia, make industrial production much harder, make military production much harder. But of course, the source of the inflows for the government comes from oil and gas. What would that mean for the financial system? I personally think it would have a secondary effect. To me, it would have a direct effect on Russia's ability to finance the war. The financial system could be sort of shaken as a result of this indirectly. But here, the focus would be more at the core of the government's ability to generate money to pay for the war.
Nicola, please.
No, I basically agree. I see we have really good people in the audience, so I'm impatient for us to move on and give them the floor.
Absolutely, I'm going to very quickly open the floor, but I have a very one last question to Elina specifically, because I know that she has been reflecting on this. What in the longer run could there be also counter sanctions from Russian side?
Historically, Russian authorities have been very ineffective with their counter sanctions. I mean, they've kind of tried to target individual countries. They try to sort of aim at fragmenting Europe, and we know that in Europe consensus is needed on sanctions, and that's where, you know, the Russia has potential and opportunity, especially on oil and gas. And we saw Hungary already making comments that they will pay in rubles, whatever that scheme might be. So Russia's ability to produce counter-sanctions ends up hurting them more than it hurts anybody else. We know already that Russia is prohibited export of sexually exported so wheat. But in the end of the day, it's going to hurt domestic production, because there will be, you know, domestic agricultural producer will not plant as much for the next year. And then also next year, when they need some of the imported seeds, and they do import seeds, they will not get them because the foreign companies will say, wait a second, we're not very happy. So again, I think Russia's ability to do counter sanctions, in my view, in my experience, in our experience, has been limited. I would only point out that there are some critical metals that might be not very critical for Russia's balance of payments, but they're definitely critical for some of the global car manufacturing and digital or production. So it's definitely something to watch.
Thank you, Elina. And of course, as Nicola has anticipated, I would like to invite a few people to join us on stage and ask a question to both of you.
While people are preparing questions, I have a question to Elina, which is forward-looking on what she commented on in terms of the ruble rate. How do you see that going forward? Do you think that the ruble will stay stable for the foreseeable future, or do you think there could be new episodes of volatility in this exchange rate, which, as you rightly explained, doesn't mean much at this point?
Oh, thank you. That's a fantastic question. It has something to do with Russia's outflows. And the outflows take many forms. It can be sort of other outflows by residents. It can be gross investment abroad. And if you look at the long history of Russian balance of payments, there is always this gray area of some outflows. And I know the Central Bank of Russia made studies. We have made studies as well. So this, why is this important? Because it can be in Russia very non-linear and leaky. And that's where the central bank now, right now, is between a rock and a hard place. On one side, they do feel that it's a bit too strong. And I think generally, central bank doesn't think too much about the implications for the fiscal revenues. But now it's different. Now we're back to USSR. So probably central bank thinks about implications for fiscal. And as we know, oil and gas revenues, they are in foreign exchange, 50% of revenues. If that depreciates a little bit, that's an increase to your revenues almost directly, right? So that is important for the budget and financing. So the central well, on the individuals, on the small individuals, you know, the sort of smaller FX deposit holders, they would not want to see massive speculation by oligarchs or large enterprises taking money abroad, you know, for those who are still not sanctioned. So I think that's where, so I see them trying to loosen up the exchange rate to try to move it a little bit weaker. So that's my key sort of expectation. Another one is because of sanctions, and of course there is no more fiscal rule at the moment, the central bank cannot accumulate reserves. So to the extent, I'm curious, would they try to use one of the non-sanctioned banks to accumulate pseudo reserves? And we know that there is the interpretation of sanctions that would prevent that. And also there is a risk. If there is an unsanctioned bank now, it might be sanctioned down the road. These are the two things I'm sure central bank is struggling with now. And last comment on volatility, We all remember 2014 December in Hainan liquid market. And I know that I think New Economic School made a study on that. It was one of the sort of friends of family of Putin that was trying to take money out. And that's what blew up the FX market at that moment. That's one of the interpretation. So we always worry about, for the central bank, about friends and family trying to exit and creating this volatility on the ruble. But of course, this is something the central bank and authorities in this sort of militarized pseudo-Soviet economy will try to avoid.
Thank you, Elena. And in the meantime, I have a speaker from the floor who came and joined us on stage. I would like to ask the person to identify themselves and ask the question.
Hi, my name is Mia. I live in Louisiana in the United States of America. I'm a semi-retired programmer. I'm concerned that sanctions whether or not sanctions could be used after the war is over to coerce or, I don't know what a polite word would be, coerce Russia into cooperating with war crime tribunals and or with providing restitution, because I know that they have done horrible damage to important infrastructure like hospitals and schools and bridges and so on. And to me, it's like ending the war is like the first step, but there's a lot of reparations and war crimes to be charged. And I just wondered, can and have people used sanctions in the past to achieve those goals? I just don't know.
Nicola or Elena, can you reply?
It's a great question. It's also, in my view, a question for the distant future, because the war is raging. And I think many of us find it implausible that it would end anytime soon. So one piece of, in a way, good news is that Russia has not been willing to escalate to non-conventional warfare, at least for the time being. And if this war stays in the conventional realm, it could last quite long. So questions about what happens after the war is over maybe questions about the medium and perhaps long term. And of course, the answer to those questions will depend on how the war ends. And I don't think anybody has a clue at this point about this question. I want to emphasize the fact that the military response of Ukraine and the way they repelled the assault on Kyiv, but also on Kharkiv, and prevented any assault on Odessa, for example, is something that no mainstream military analyst, at least outside of Ukraine, to my knowledge, had predicted. So wars are unpredictable. The military situation is unpredictable. It will probably bring other unpredictable developments, or at least unpredicted. We will rationalize them exposed, as we always do, but we didn't know them ex ante. And so I think we have to be very humble at this point on any anticipation of how this war will and when.
Thank you, Nicola. I have one last intervention from the floor, because then our time is going to be over, unfortunately. And I invite Michael to speak. Michael, could you introduce yourself?
Of course. Thank you, Giuseppe. My name is Michael Bond. I'm a lawyer from Canada. My question is about reports in the last few days about the Chinese union pay system, stating that they're not going to move ahead with cooperation with Russian banks, particularly Sberbank, on the basis that they're concerned there could be future sanctions against them now that Sberbank has been added to many of the Western sanctions lists. So I'm curious about how significant a blow is that for Russia, in that they won't have an immediate replacement for Visa, MasterCard. And then related to that, I also saw that apparently Poland has initiated a review now that UnionPay had gotten more prominence. So what is the impact for Russia of them not proceeding? But then also, is it likely that European and more broadly Western countries will be taking a closer look at UnionPay and potentially slowing their engagement around the world?
Thank you, Michael. Who would like to take Elena, please?
Maybe I'll just start. Yes. So I think Visa and MasterCard, they particularly do not operate outside. So it's sort of hits a lot of people that are trying to exit Russia and try to access their accounts outside. Domestically, still some operations are continuing. So that's what I understand. On the Union Pay, indeed, they've quietly withdrew from the discussions with Russian banks, Russian sanctioned banks, apparently, and maybe Nikola can add more to that, but I understand that they didn't make a public statement, but they just sort of withdrew out of concern for secondary sanctions. And it's unlikely to go ahead. So Russia used to rely on the settlement system. The settlement system is domestic. The messaging system is SWIFT, used to be used for domestic purposes as well as international purposes. And then there are cards. And Russia has this card that is called MIR. MIR, which is ironically is peace or the world, right? It's neither, appears, because it's not really widely accepted. You know, even in Turkey, there are issues. It's accepted in some of the places, so it was supposed to have been accepted in some of the places where Russian tourists go more frequently to, but apparently there are difficulties. So what it means that for Russians that are trying to exit the country, they will need to find other ways of getting the money, because there you cannot take out more than 10,000, obviously, and you oftentimes cannot withdraw that, even though now the FX controls are being loosened up a little bit. In terms of the domestic processing, I was personally somewhat surprised that they went very smoothly in terms of the replacing SWIFT. You know, they have the domestic messaging system, and that seems to be operating fine, even though it's less efficient and it takes longer time. It used to process, I think, 30% of the total volume of the messages. Now it has to do 100 because Russia used to use SWIFT for that. In terms of the cards, the card MIR was already being introduced before because it is state-controlled bank, very quickly away from cash. So that might also help them. And of course, finally, before the war, Central Bank of Russia was working on CBDC, was launched the pilot already with 17 banks. And given how concentrated the system is, it was the maturity of the banks. Of course, now with the war, they have other problems, and also with the technological export controls, they might have find it harder to proceed with that project, or at least proceed at the planned speed. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
We could keep discussing this for length, but that's all the time that we have for this episode. So thanks. And unfortunately, we are going towards the end of this episode. So we could keep discussing more about the issue, but we will come back discussing our analysis on the various aspects of the economic fallout of the war in Ukraine in the next episodes of The Sound of Economics. Stay tuned with us and check also the previous episodes and our overall coverage of the economic consequences of the war on our website www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot, Elena and Nicholas, as well as all the listeners and those that intervened in the discussion today on Twitter Spaces. And thanks for all of you tuning in to listen to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you, too. Bye.
Thank you.